Side 13. Christine. Continuing on page 494. She came back, and I saw that she was holding an O-cedar mop, the kind with a wide yellow sponge along the foot. Would this be any good? Only perfect, I said. Get in, kiddo. We're in business. She climbed up once more, and I pushed the clutch down with the mop. Lots better, I said. Where did you find it? In the bathroom, she said, and wrinkled her nose. Bad in there? Dirty, reeking of cigars, and there's a whole pile of moldy books in the corner. The kind they sell at those little hole-in-the-wall stores. So that was what Darnell left behind him, I thought. An empty garage, a pile of beeline books, and a phantom reek of Roy Tan cigars. I felt cold again and thought that if I had my way, I'd see this place bulldozed flat and pasted over with hot top. I could not shake the feeling that it was an unmarked grave of a sort, the place where LeVay and Christine had killed my friend's mind and taken over his life. I can't wait to get out of here, Lee said, looking around nervously. Really? I kind of like it. I was thinking of moving in. I caressed her shoulder and looked deeply into her eyes. We could start a family, I breathed. She held up a fist. Want me to start a nosebleed? No, that's all right. For what it's worth, I can't wait to get out of here either. I drove Petunia the rest of the way inside. I found that I could run the clutch pretty well using the O-cedar mop, in first gear at least. The handle had a tendency to bend, and I would have preferred something thicker, but it would have to do unless we could find something better in the meantime. We've got to turn off the lights again, I said, killing the engine. The wrong people might see them. She got out and turned them off, while I swung Petunia in a wide circle and then carefully backed it up until the rear end almost touched the window between the garage and Darnell's office. Now the big truck's snout was pointing directly back at the open overhead door through which we had entered. With the lights off, the shadows descended again. The light coming in through the open door was weak, muted by the snow, white and without strength. It spread on the oil-stained, cracked concrete like a pie wedge, and simply died halfway across the floor.
I'm cold, Dennis, Lee called from Darnell's office. He's got the switches for the heat marked. Can I turn them on?
Go ahead, I called back. A moment later, the garage whispered with the sound of the blowers. I leaned back against the seat, gently running my hands over my left leg. The material of my jeans was stretched smoothly over the thigh, tight and without a wrinkle. The son of a bitch was swelling, and it hurt. Christ, did it hurt! Lee came back and climbed up beside me. She told me again how terrible I looked, and for some reason my mind cross-patched, and I thought of the afternoon Arnie had brought Christine down here, of the bebop queen's husband yelling for Arnie to get that hunk of junk out from in front of his house, and of Arnie telling me the guy was a regular Robert Deadford, how he had gotten the giggles. I closed my eyes against the sting of tears. With nothing to do but wait, time slowed down. It was 1:45, then 2:00. Outside, the snow had thickened a little, but not much. Lee got out of the truck and pushed the button that trundled the door back down. That made it even darker inside. She came back, climbed up, and said, "There's a funny gadget on the side of the door. See it? It looks just like the electronic garage door opener we used to have when we lived in Weston." I sat up suddenly, stared at it. "Oh," I said, "oh, Jesus. What's the matter?" "That's just what it is, a garage door opener. And there's one of the transmitter gadgets on Christine. Arnie mentioned that to me Thanksgiving night. You've got to break it, Lee. Use the handle of that push broom." So she got down again, picked up the broom handle, and stood below the electric eye gadget, looking up and bashing at it with the handle. She looked like a woman trying to kill a bug near the ceiling. At last, she was rewarded with a crunch of plastic and tinkle of glass. She came back slowly, tossing the broom handle aside, and got up beside me. "Dennis, don't you think it's time you told me exactly what you've got in mind?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean," she said, and pointed at the closed overhead door. 5 square windows in a line 3/4 of the way up its height let in minimal light through dirty glass. "When it gets dark, you plan to open that door again, don't you?" I nodded. The door itself was wood, but it was braced with hinged steel strips, like the inner gate of an old-time elevator. I'd let her in, but once the door was shut,
Christine wouldn't be able to bash her way back out again, I hoped. It made me cold to think how close we'd come to overlooking the electronic door opener. Open the door at dusk, yes. Let Christine in, yes. Close the door again. Then I would use Petunia to batter her to death. Okay, she said, that's the trap, but once she, it, comes in, how are you going to get that door shut again to keep her in? Maybe there's a button in Darnell's office that does it, but I didn't see it. So far as I know, there isn't one, I said. So you're going to be standing over there by the button that shuts the door. I pointed. The manual button was located on the right side of the door, about 2 feet below the ruins of the electric door opener box. You'll be against the wall, out of sight. When Christine comes in, always assuming she does, you're going to push the button that starts the door coming down, and then step outside in a hurry. The door comes down, and bam, the trap's shut. Her face set. On you as well as her. In the words of the immortal Wordsworth, that sucks. That's Coleridge, not Wordsworth. There's no other way to do it, Lee. If you're still inside when that door comes down, Christine is going to run you down. Even if there was a button in Darnell's office. Well, you saw in the paper what happened to the side of his house. Her face was stubborn. Park over by the switch, and when she comes in, I'll reach out the window and hit the button and lower the door. If I park there, I'll be in sight, and if this tank is in sight, she won't come in. I don't like it, she burst out. I don't like leaving you alone. It's like you tricked me. In a way, that's just what I had done, and for whatever it's worth, I would not do it the same way now. But I was going on 18 then, and there's no male chauvinist pig like an 18-year-old male chauvinist pig. I put an arm around her shoulders. She resisted stiffly for a moment, and then came to me. There's just no other way, I said. If it wasn't for my leg, or if you could drive a standard shift... I shrugged.
I'm scared for you, Dennis. I want to help.
You'll be helping plenty. You're the one that's really in danger, Lee. You'll be outside, on the floor, when she comes in. I'm just going to sit up here in the cab and beat that bitch back into component parts.
I only hope it works that way, she said, and put her head on my chest.
I touched her hair. So, we waited. In my mind's eye, I could see Arnie coming out of the main building at LHS, books under his arm. I could see Regina waiting for him there in the Cunningham's compact wagon, radiant with happiness. Arnie smiling remotely and submitting to her embrace. Arnie, you've made the right decision. You don't know how relieved, how happy your father and I are. Yes, Mom. Do you want to drive, honey? No, you drive, Mom. That's okay. The two of them setting off for Penn State through the light snow, Regina driving, Arnie sitting in the shotgun seat with his hands folded stiffly in his lap, his face pale and unsmiling and clear of acne. And back in the student parking lot at LHS, Christine sitting silently in the driveway, waiting for the snow to thicken, waiting for dark. At 3:30 or so, Lee went back through Darnell's office to use the bathroom, and while she was gone, I dry-swallowed 2 more Darvon. My leg was a steady, leaden agony. Shortly after that, I lost coherent track of time. The dope had me fuddled, I guess. The whole thing began to seem dreamlike. The deepening shadows, the white light coming in through the windows slowly changing to an ashy gray, the drone of the overhead heaters. I think that Lee and I made love. Not in the ordinary way, not with my leg the way it was, but some kind of sweet substitute. I seemed to remember her breath steepening in my ear until she was nearly panting. I seemed to remember her whispering for me to be careful, to please be careful, that she had lost Arnie and could not bear to lose me, too. I seemed to remember an explosion of pleasure that made the pain disappear in a brief but total way that not all the Darvon in the world could manage. But brief was the right word. It was all too brief. And then I think I dozed. The next thing I remember for sure was Lee shaking me fully awake and whispering my name over and over in my ear. Huh? What? I was spaced out and my leg was full of a glassy pain, simply waiting to explode. There was an ache in my temples, and my eyes felt too big for their sockets. I blinked around at Lee like a large stupid owl.
It's dark, she said. I thought I heard something.
I blinked again and saw that she looked drawn and frightened. Then I glanced toward the door and saw that it was standing wide open.
How the hell did that... Me, she said. I opened it.
Cripes.
I said, straightening up a little and wincing at the pain in my leg. That wasn't too smartly. If she had come...
She didn't, Lee said. It started to get dark, that's all, and to snow harder. So I got out and opened the door, and then I came back here. I kept thinking you'd wake up in a minute. You were mumbling. And I kept thinking, I'll wait until it's really dark. I'll just wait until it's really dark. And then I saw I was fooling myself, because it's been dark for almost half an hour now, and I was only thinking I could still see some light. Because I wanted to see it, I guess, and just now, I thought I heard something.
Her lips began to tremble, and she pressed them tightly together. I looked at my watch and saw that it was 5:45. If everything had gone right, my parents and sister would be together with Michael and Lee's folks now. I looked through Petunia's windshield at the square of snow-shot darkness where the garage entrance was. I could hear the wind shrieking. A thin creeper of snow had already blown in onto the cement.
You just heard the wind, I said uneasily. It's walking and talking out there.
Maybe, but...
I nodded reluctantly. I didn't want her to leave the safety of Petunia's high cab, but if she didn't go now, maybe she never would. I wouldn't let her, and she would let me not let her. And then, when and if Christine came, all she would have to do would be to reverse back out of Darnell's and wait for a more opportune time. Okay, I said, but remember, stand back in that little niche to the right of the door. If she comes, she may just stand outside for a while, scenting the air like an animal, I thought. Don't get scared. Don't move. Don't let her freak you into giving yourself away. Just be cool and wait until she comes in. Then push that button and get the hell out. Do you understand?
Yes, she whispered. Dennis, will this work?
It should, if she comes at all.
I won't see you until it's over.
I guess that's so. She leaned over, placed her left hand lightly on the side of my neck, and kissed my mouth.
Be careful, Dennis, she said.
But kill it. It's not really a she at all, just an it. Kill it. I will, I said. She looked in my eyes and nodded.
Do it for Arnie, she said.
Set him free. I hugged her hard, and she hugged me back. Then she slid across the seat. She hit her little handbag with her knee, and it fell to the floor of the cab. She paused, head cocked, a startled, thoughtful look in her eyes. Then she smiled, bent over, picked it up, and began to rummage quickly through it.
Dennis,
she said, you remember the Mort d'Arthur?
A little.
One of the classes Lee and Arnie and I had all shared before my football injury was Fudgy Bowen's Classics of English Literature, and one of the first things we had been faced with in there was Mallory's Mort d'Arthur. Why Lee asked me this now was a mystery to me. She'd found what she wanted. It was a filmy pink scarf, nylon, the sort of thing a girl wears over her head on a day when a misty sort of rain is falling. She tied it around the left forearm of my parka. What the hell? I asked, smiling a little.
Be my knight, she said, and smiled back, but her eyes were serious. Be my knight, Dennis.
I picked up the squeegee mop she had found in Will's bathroom and made a clumsy salute with it.
Sure,
I said. Just call me Sir O'Cedar.
Joke about it if you want, she said. But don't really joke about it, okay?
All right, I said. If that's what you want, I'll be your parfy goddamn genteel knight.
She laughed a little, and that was better. Remember about that button, kiddo. Push it hard. We don't want that door to just burp once and stop on its track. No escapes, right?
Right.
She got out of Petunia, and I can close my eyes now and see her as she was then, in that clean and silent moment just before everything went terribly wrong. A tall, pretty girl with long blonde hair the color of raw honey, slim hips, long legs, and those striking Nordic cheekbones, now wearing a ski parka and faded Lee Riders, moving with a dancer's grace. I can still see it, and I still dream about it, because, of course, while we were busy setting up Christine, she was busy setting us up, that old and infinitely wise monster. Did we really think we could outsmart her so easily? I guess we did. My dreams are in terrible slow motion. I can see the softly lovely motion of her hips as she walks. I can hear the hollow click of her fry boots on the oil-stained cement floor. I can even hear the soft, dry whish-whish of her parka's quilted inner lining brushing against her blouse. She's walking slowly, and her head is up. Now she is the animal, but no predator. She walks with the cautious grace of a zebra approaching a waterhole at dusk. It is the walk of an animal that scents danger. I try to scream to her through Petunia's windshield. Come back, Lee. Come back quick. You were right. You heard something. She's out there now, out there in the snow with her headlights off. Crouch down. Lee, come back. She stopped suddenly, her hands tensing into fists. And that was when sudden, savage circles of light sprang to life in the snowy dark outside. They were like white eyes opening. Lee froze, hideously exposed, on the open floor. She was 30 feet inside the door and slightly to the right of center. She turned toward the headlights, and I could see the dazed, uncertain expression on her face. I was just as stunned, and that first vital moment passed unused. Then the headlights sprang forward, and I could see the dark, low-slung shape of Christine behind them. I could hear the mounting, furious howl of her engine as she leaped toward us from across the street where she had been waiting all along, maybe even since before dark. Snow funneled back from her roof and skirled across her windshield in filmy nets that were almost instantly melted by the defroster. She hit the tarmac leading up to the entrance, still gaining speed. Her engine was a V8 scream of rage. Lee! I screamed, and clawed for Petunia's ignition switch. Lee broke to the right and ran for the wall button. Christine roared inside as she reached it and pushed it. I heard the rattle rumble of the overhead door descending on its track. Christine came in, angling to the right, going for Lee. She dug a great clout of dry wood and splinters from the wall. There was a metallic screech as part of her right bumper pulled loose, a sound like a drunk's scream of laughter. Sparks cascaded across the floor as she went into a long, slewing turn. She missed Lee, but she wouldn't when she went back. Lee was stuck in that right-hand corner with nowhere to hide. She might be able to make it outside, but I was terribly afraid that the door wasn't coming down fast enough to cut off Christine. The descending door might peel off her roof, but that wouldn't stop her, and I knew it. Petunia's engine bellowed, and I dragged out the headlight button. Her brights came on, splashing over the closing door and over Lee. She was backed up against the wall, her eyes wide. Her parka took on a weird, almost electric blue color in the headlights, and my mind informed me with sickening and clinical accuracy that her blood would look purple. I saw her glance upward for a moment, and then back down at Christine. The Fury's tires screamed violently as she leaped at Lee. Smoke rose from the new black marks on the concrete. I just had time to register the fact that there were people inside of Christine, a whole carload of them. At the same instant that Christine roared toward her, Lee leaped upward with a big ungainly jack-in-the-box spring. My mind, seeming to run at a speed approaching light, wondered for a moment if she was intending to leap right over the Plymouth, as if instead of fries, she wore boots of the 7-league variety. Instead, she caught and gripped the rusted metal struts, which supported an overhead shelf almost 9 feet above the floor, over 3 feet above her head. This shelf skirted all four walls. On the night Arnie and I had first brought Christine in, that entire shelf had been crammed with recapped tires and old Baldies waiting to be recapped. In some funny way, it had reminded me of a well-stocked library shelf. Now it was mostly empty. Holding those angled struts, Lee swung her jeaned legs up like a kid who means to throw his legs right over his own shoulders, what we used to call skinning the cat in grammar school. Christine's snout smashed into the wall directly below her. If she had been any slower getting her legs up, they would have been mashed off at the knees. A piece of chrome flew. Two of the remaining tires tumbled from the shelf and bounced crazily on the cement like giant rubber donuts. Lee's head smashed back against the wall with battering, dazing force as Christine reversed, all four of her tires laying rubber and squirting blue smoke. And what was I doing all this time, you wonder? It wasn't all that time, that is my answer. Even as I used the O-Cedar mop to depress Petunia's clutch and gear into first, the overhead door was just thumping down. All of it had happened in the space of seconds. Lee was still holding onto the struts supporting the tire shelf, but now she only hung there, head down, dazed. I let the clutch out, and a cold part of my mind took over. Easy, man, if you pop the clutch and stall this fucker, she's dead. Petunia rolled. I revved the engine up to a bellow and let the clutch out all the way. Christine roared at Lee again, her hood crimped almost double from her first hit, bright metal showing through the broken paint at the sharpest points of bend. It looked as if her hood and grill had grown shark's teeth.
I hit Christine 3/4 of the way toward the front, and she slid around, one of her tires pulling off the rim. The 58 slammed into a litter of old bumper jacks and junk parts in one corner. There was a booming crash as she struck the wall, and then the hot sound of her engine, revving and falling off, revving and falling off. The entire left front end was bashed in, but she was still running. I slammed on Petunia's brake with my right foot and barely managed to avoid crushing Lee myself. Petunia's engine stalled. Now, the only sound in the garage was Christine's screaming engine. "Lee!" I screamed over it. "Lee, run!" She looked over at me groggily, and now I could see sticky braids of blood in her hair. It was as purple as I had expected. She let go of the struts, landed on her feet, staggered, and went to one knee. Christine came for her. Lee got up, took two wobbling steps, and got on her blind side, behind Petunia. Christine swerved and struck the truck's front end. I was thrown roughly to the right. Pain roared through my left leg. "Get up!" I screamed at Lee, trying to lean even farther over and open the door. "Get up!" Christine backed off, and when she came again, she cut hard to the right and went out of my line of vision, around the back of Petunia. I caught just a glimpse of her in the rearview mirror bolted outside the driver's side window. Then I could only hear the scream of her tires. Barely conscious, Lee simply wandered off, holding both hands laced to the back of her head. Blood trickled through her fingers. She walked in front of Petunia's grill toward me, and then just stopped. I didn't have to see in order to know what was going to happen next. Christine would reverse again, back to my side, and then crush her against the wall. Desperately, I shoved the clutch in with the mop and keyed the engine again. It turned over, coughed, stalled. I could smell gasoline in the air, heavy and rich. I had flooded the engine. Christine reappeared in the rearview mirror. She came at Lee, who managed to stumble backward just out of reach. Christine slammed nose-on into the wall with crunching force. The passenger door popped open, and the horror was complete. The hand, not clutching the mop handle, went to my mouth, and I screamed through it. Sitting on the passenger side, like a grotesque, life-sized doll, was Michael Cunningham. His head, lolling limply on the stalk of his neck, snapped over to one side as Christine reversed to make another try at Lee, and I saw his face had the high, rosy color of carbon monoxide poisoning. He hadn't taken my advice. Christine had gone to the Cunninghams' house first, as I had vaguely suspected she might. Michael came home from school, and there she was, standing in the driveway, his son's restored 1958 Plymouth. He had gone to it, and somehow Christine had gotten him. Had he maybe gotten in just to sit behind the wheel for a moment, as I had that day in LeBay's garage? He might have, just to see what vibrations he could pick up. If so, he must have picked up some terrible vibes indeed during his last few minutes on Earth. Had Christine started herself up? Driven herself into the garage? Maybe, maybe. And had Michael discovered that he could neither turn off the madly revving engine or get out of the car? Had he maybe turned his head and perhaps seen the true guiding spirit of Arnie's 58 Fury lounging in the shotgun seat and fainted in terror? It didn't matter now. Lee was all that mattered. She had seen, too. Her screams, high, despairing, and shrill, floated in the exhaust-stinking air like hysterically bright balloons. But it had at least cut through her daze. She turned and ran for Will Darnell's office, blood spattering behind her in dime-sized drops as she went. Blood was soaking into the collar of her parka. Too much blood. Christine backed up, laying rubber and leaving a scatter of glass behind. As she pulled around in a tight circle to go after Lee, centrifugal force pulled the passenger door shut again, but not before I saw Michael's head loll back the other way. Christine held still for a moment, her nose pointed toward Lee, her engine revving. Perhaps LeBay was savoring the instant before the kill. If so, I'm glad, because if Christine had gone for her right away, she would have been killed then. But as it was, I had an instant of time. I turned the key again, babbling something aloud, a prayer, I guess, and this time Petunia's engine coughed into life. I let the clutch out and stepped down on the accelerator as Christine leaped forward again. This time I struck her right side. There was a shrill scream of tearing metal as Petunia's bumper punched through her mudguard. Christine heeled over and smashed against the wall. Glass broke. Her engine raced and raved. Behind the wheel, LeBay turned toward me, grinning with hate. Petunia stalled again. I rattled off a string of every curse I knew as I grabbed for the key again. If not for my goddamn leg, if not for the fall I'd taken in the snow, this would be over now. It would just be a matter of cornering her and smashing her to pieces against the cinder block. But even as I cranked Petunia's engine, keeping my foot off the gas to keep from stalling her again, Christine began to reverse with an ear-splitting squeal of metal. She backed out from between Petunia's grill and the wall,
leaving a twisted chunk of her red body behind, bearing her right front tire. I got Petunia going and found reverse. Christine had backed all the way down to the far end of the garage. All her headlights were out. Her windshield was smashed into a galaxy of cracks. The bent hood seemed to sneer. Her radio was blasting. I could hear Ricky Nelson singing, "Waitin' in School." I stared around for Lee and saw her in Will's office, looking out into the garage. Her blonde hair was matted with blood. More blood ran down the left side of her face and soaked into her jacket. Bleeding too damn much, I thought incoherently. Bleeding too damn much, even for a head wound. Her eyes widened, and she pointed past me, her lips moving soundlessly behind the glass. Christine came roaring straight up the empty floor, gaining speed. And the hood was uncrimping, straightening out and down to cover the motor cavity again. Two of the headlights flickered, then came back strong. The mudguard and the right-hand side of her body, I only caught a glimpse, but I swear it's true, they were re-knitting themselves, red metal appearing from nowhere and slipping down in smooth automotive curves to cover the right front tire and the right side of the engine compartment again. The cracks in the windshield were running inward and disappearing, and the tire that had been pulled off its rim looked as good as new. It all looks as good as new, I thought. God help us. She was going directly for the wall between the garage and the office. I let the mop handle off the clutch fast, hoping to interpose the tanker's body, but Christine got past me. Petunia backed into nothing but thin air. Oh, I was doing great. I backed all the way across the floor and crashed into the dented tool lockers ranged there. They crashed to the floor with dull metallic janglings. Through the windshield, I saw Christine hit the wall between the garage and Will's office. She never slowed. She went full speed ahead. I'll never forget those next few moments. They remain hypnotically clear in my memory, as if seen through a magnifying crystal. Lee saw Christine coming and stumbled backward. Her bloody hair was matted to her head. She fell over Will's swivel chair. She hit the floor out of sight behind his desk. An instant later, and I mean the barest instant, Christine slammed into the wall. The big window Will had used to keep track of the comings and goings out in his garage exploded inward. Glass flew like a cluster of deadly spears. Christine's front end bulged with the impact. The hood popped up and then tore off, flying back over the roof to land on the concrete with a metallic sound that was much like the sound the falling tool lockers had made. Her windshield shattered, and Michael Cunningham's body flew through the jagged opening, legs trailing, his head a grotesque flattened football. He was catapulted through Will's window. He struck Will's desk with a heavy grain sack thud and skidded over onto the floor. His shoes stuck up. Lee began to scream. Her fall had probably saved her from being badly lacerated or killed by the flying glass, but when she rose from behind the desk, her face was contorted with horror, and utter hysteria had its hold on her. Michael had skidded from the desk, and his arms had looped themselves over her shoulders, and as Lee struggled to her feet, she appeared to be waltzing with the corpse. Her screams were like fire bells. Her blood, still flowing, sparkled deadly bright. She dumped Michael and ran for the door. "Lee, no!" I screamed, and slammed down the clutch with the mop again. The handle snapped cleanly in two, leaving me with a stump 5 inches long. Oh, shit! Christine reversed away from the broken window, leaving water, antifreeze, and oil puddled on the floor. I stamped down on the clutch with my left foot, barely feeling the pain now, bracing my left knee with my left hand as I worked the gear shift. Lee tore the office door open and ran out. Christine turned toward her, its smashed, snarling snout sighting down on her. I revved Petunia's engine and roared at her. And as that damned car from hell grew in the windshield, I saw the purple, swollen face of a child pressed to the rear window, watching me, seeming to beg me to stop. I struck her hard. The trunk lid popped up and gaped like a mouth. The rear end heeled around, and Christine went skidding sideways past Lee, who fled with her eyes seeming to swallow her face. I remember the spray of blood along the fur fringe of her parka's hood, tiny droplets like an evil fall of dew. I was in it now. I was in the peak seat. Even if they had to take my leg off at the groin when this was done, I was going to drive. Christine hit the wall and bounced back. I stamped the clutch, rammed the gear shift into reverse, backed up 10 feet, stamped the clutch again, rammed it back into first. Engine revving, Christine tried to pull away along the wall. I cut to the left and hit her again, crushing her almost wasp-waisted in the middle. The doors popped out of their frames at the top and the bottom. LeBay was behind the wheel, now a skull, now a decayed and stinking cameo of humanity, now a hale and hearty man in his 50s with a crew cut turning white. He stared out at me with his devil's grin, one hand on the wheel, one balled into a fist that he shook at me. and still her engine would not die. I got into reverse again, and now my leg was white iron, and the pain was all the way up to my left armpit. The hell it was. The pain was everywhere. I could feel it. Michael, Jesus, why didn't you stay in the house? In my neck, in my jaw, in my... Arnie, man, I'm so sorry. I wish... Temples, the Plymouth, what remained of her, lunged drunkenly down the side of the garage, spraying tools and junk metal, pulling out struts and dumping the overhead shelves. The shelves hit the concrete with flat clapping sounds that echoed like demon applause. I stamped the clutch again and floored the gas. Petunia's engine bellowed, and I hung onto the wheel like a man trying to stay aboard a bucking Mustang. I hit her on the right side and smashed the body clear off the rear axle, driving it into the door, which shivered and rattled. I went up over the wheel, which slammed into my belly and drove the breath out of me and dumped me back into my seat, gasping. Now I saw Lee, cowering in the far corner, her hands clapped to her face, dragging it down into a witch's mask. Christine's engine was still running. She dragged herself slowly down toward Lee like an animal whose rear legs have been broken in a trap. And even as she went, I could see her regenerating, coming back, a tire that suddenly popped up full and plump, the radio antenna that unjointed itself with a silvery twing sound, the accretion of metal around the ruined rear end. "Stay dead!" I screamed at it. I was crying, my chest heaving. My leg wouldn't work anymore. I braced it with both hands and jammed it onto the clutch. My vision went hazy and gray with the white metal agony. I could almost feel the bones grating. I raced the engine, got first gear again, and charged it. And as I did, I heard LeBay's voice for the first and only time, high and cheated and full of a terrible, unquenchable fury. "You shitter! Fuck off, you miserable shitter! Leave me alone!" "You should have left my friend alone," I tried to yell, but all that would come out was a tearing, wounded gasp. I hit it squarely in the rear end, and the gas tank ruptured as the back of the car accordioned inward and upward in a kind of metal mushroom. There was a yellow lick of fire. I shielded my face with my hands, but then it was gone. Christine sat there, a refugee from a demolition derby. Her engine ran choppily, missed, fired again, and then died. The place was silent, except for the bass rumble of Petunia's engine. Then Lee was running across the floor, screaming my name over and over, crying. I was suddenly, stupidly, aware that I was wearing her pink nylon scarf around the arm of my jacket. I looked down at it, and then the world grayed out again. I could feel her hands on me, and then there was nothing but darkness as I fainted. I came to about 15 minutes later, my face wet and blessedly cool. Lee was standing on Petunia's driver's side running board, mopping my face with a wet rag. I caught it in one hand, tried to suck it, and then spat. The rag tasted strongly of oil. "Dennis, don't worry," she said. "I ran out into the street, stopped a snowplow. Scared the poor man out of 10 years of his life, I think. All this blood. He said, an ambulance. He said he'd, you know. Dennis, are you all right?" "Do I look all right?" I whispered. "No," she said, and burst into tears. "Then don't." I swallowed past a painful dry lump in my throat. "Don't ask stupid questions. I love you." She hugged me clumsily. "He said he'd call the police, too," she said. I barely heard her. My eyes had found the twisted, silent hulk that was Christine's remains, and hulk was the right word. She hardly looked like a car at all anymore. But why hadn't she burned? A hubcap lay off to one side like a dented silver tiddlywink. "How long since you stopped the plow?" I asked hoarsely. "Maybe 5 minutes. Then I got the rag and dipped it in that bucket over there. Dennis, thank God it's over." Bunk, bunk, bunk. I was still looking at the hubcap. The dents were popping out of it. Abruptly, it flicked up on its rim and rolled toward the car like a huge coin. Lee saw it, too. Her face froze. Her eyes widened and began to bulge. Her lips mouthed the word, "No," but no sound came out. "Get in here with me," I said in a low voice, as if it could hear us. "How do I know? Perhaps it could." "Get in on the passenger side. You're going to run the gas while I run the clutch with my right foot." "No." This time it was a hissing whisper. Her breath came in whining little gasps. "No, no." The wreckage was quivering all over. It was the most eerie, most terrible thing I have ever seen in my life. It was quivering all over, quivering like an animal that is not quite dead. Metal tapped nervously against metal. Tie rods clicked jittery jazz rhythms against their connectors. As I watched, a bent cotter pin lying on the floor straightened itself and did half a dozen cartwheels to land in the wreckage. "Get in," I said.
"Dennis, I can't."
Her lips quivered helplessly.
"I can't. No more. That body. That was Arnie's father. I can't. No more, please."
"You have to," I said. She looked at me, glanced affrightedly back at the obscenely quivering remains of that old whore Libet and Arnie had shared, and then came around Petunia's front end. A piece of chrome tumbled and scratched her leg deeply. She screamed and ran. She clambered up into the cab and pushed over beside me.
"What do I do?"
I hung halfway out of the cab, holding onto the roof, and pushed the clutch down with my right foot. Petunia's engine was still running. "Just gun the gas and keep it gunned," I said, "no matter what." Steering with my right hand, holding on with my left, I let the clutch out, and we rolled forward and smashed into the wreckage, smashing it, scattering it. And in my head, I seemed to hear another scream of fury. Lee clapped her hands to her head.
"I can't, Dennis, I can't do it. It's screaming."
"You've got to do it," I said. Her foot had come off the gas, and now I could hear sirens in the night, rising and falling. I grabbed her shoulder, and a sickening blast of pain ripped up my leg. "Lee, nothing has changed. You've got to."
"It screamed at me."
"We're running out of time, and it still isn't done. Just a little more."
"I'll try,"
she whispered, and stepped on the gas again. I shifted into reverse. Petunia rolled back 20 feet. I clutched again, got first, and Lee suddenly cried out,
"Dennis, no, don't! Look!"
The mother and the little girl, Veronica and Rita, were standing in front of the smashed and dented hulk of Christine, hand in hand, their faces solemn and sorrowing. "They're not there," I said, "and if they are, it's time they went back." More pain in my leg and the world went gray. "Back to where they belong. Keep your foot on it." I let out the clutch and Petunia rolled forward again, gaining speed. The two figures did not disappear, as TV and movie ghosts do. They seemed to stream out in every direction, bright colors fading to wash pinks and blues, and then they were totally gone. We slammed into Christine again, spinning what was left of her around. Metal shrieked and tore.
"Not there," Lee whispered. "Not really there. Okay, okay, Dennis."
Her voice was coming from far down a dark hallway. I fetched up reverse, and back we went. Then forward. We hit it. We hit it again. How many times? I don't know. We just kept slamming into it. And every time we did, another jolt of pain would go up my leg, and things would get a little bit darker. At last I looked up blearily, and saw that the air outside the door seemed full of blood, but it wasn't blood. It was a pulsing red light reflecting off the falling snow. People were rattling at the door out there.
"Is it good enough?" Lee asked me.
I looked at Christine, only it wasn't Christine anymore. It was a spread-out pile of twisted, gored metal, puffs of upholstery, and glittering broken glass.
"Have to be," I said.
"Let them in, Lee." And while she went, I fainted again. Then there were a series of confused images, things that came into focus for a while and then faded or disappeared completely. I can remember a stretcher being rolled out of the back of an ambulance. I can remember its sides being folded up and how the overhead fluorescents put cold headlights on its chrome. I can remember someone saying, "Cut it, you have to cut it off so we can at least look at it." I can remember someone else, Lee, I think, saying, "Don't hurt him, please, don't hurt him if you can help it." I can remember the roof of an ambulance. It had to be an ambulance because at the periphery of my vision were two suspended IV bottles. I can remember a cool swab of antiseptic and then the sting of a needle. After that, things became exceedingly weird. I knew somewhere deep inside that I was not dreaming. The pain proved that, if it proved nothing else. But all of it seemed like a dream. I was pretty well doped, and that was part of it. But shock was part of it, too. No fake, Jake. My mother was there, crying, in a room that looked sickeningly like the hospital room in which I had spent the entire autumn. Then my father was there, and Lee's dad was with him. And their faces were both so tight and grim, they looked like Tweedledum and Tweedledee, as Franz Kafka might have written them. My father bent over me and said in a voice like thunder reverberating through cotton batting, "How did Michael get there, Dennis?" That's what they really wanted to know, how Michael got there. "Oh," I thought, "oh, my friends, I could tell you stories." Then Mr. Cabot was saying, "What did you get my daughter into, boy?" I seemed to remember replying, "It's not what I got her into, it's what she got you out of." Which I still think was pretty witty under the circumstances, doped up the way I was and all. Elaine was there briefly, and she seemed to be holding a yodel or a Twinkie or something, mockingly out of my reach. Lee was there, holding her filmy nylon scarf out and asking me to raise my arm so she could tie it on, but I couldn't. My arm was like a lead bar. Then Arnie was there, and of course, that had to be a dream. "Thanks, man," he said, and I noticed with something like terror that the left lens of his glasses were shattered. His face was okay, but that broken lens, it scared me. "Thanks, you did okay. I feel better now. I think things are going to be okay now." "No sweat, Arnie," I said, or tried to say, but he was gone. It was the next day, not the 20th, but Sunday, January 21st, but I started to come back a little. My left leg was in a cast up in its old familiar position again, amid all the pulleys and weights. There was a man I had never seen before sitting to the left of my bed, reading a paperback John D. MacDonald story. He saw me looking at him and lowered his book. "Welcome back to the land of the living, Dennis," he said mildly, and deliberately marked his place in the book with a matchbook cover. He put the book in his lap and folded his hands over it. "Are you a doctor?" I asked. He sure wasn't Dr. Arroway, who had taken care of me last time. This guy was 20 years younger and at least 50 pounds leaner. He looked tough. "State Police Inspector," he said. "Richard Mercer is my name. Rick, if you like." He held out his hand, and stretching awkwardly and carefully, I touched it. I couldn't really shake it. My head ached, and I was thirsty. "Look," I said, "I don't really mind talking to you, and I'll answer all of your questions, but I'd like to see a doctor." I swallowed. He looked at me, concerned, and I blurted out, "I need to know if I'm ever going to walk again." "If what that fellow Arroway says is the truth," Mercer says, "you'll be able to get around in 4 to 6 weeks. You didn't break it again, Dennis. You severely strained it," that was what he said. "It swelled up like a sausage. He also said you were lucky to get off so cheap." "What about Arnie?" I asked. "Arnie Cunningham, do you know?" His eyes flickered. "What is it?" I asked. "What is it about Arnie?" "Dennis," he said, and then hesitated. "I don't know if this is the time. Please, is Arnie... is he dead?" Mercer sighed. "Yes, he's dead. He and his mother had an accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike in the snow. If it was an accident." I tried to talk and couldn't. I motioned for the pitcher of water on the bed table, thinking how dismal it was to be in a hospital room and know exactly where everything was. Mercer poured me a glass and put the straw with the elbow bend in it. I drank, and it got a little bit better. My throat, that is. Nothing else seemed better at all. "What do you mean, if it was an accident?" Mercer said. "It was Friday evening, and the snow just wasn't that heavy. The turnpike classification was 2, bare and wet, reduced visibility, use appropriate caution. We guessed from the force of impact that they weren't doing much more than 45. The car veered across the median and struck a semi. It was Mrs. Cunningham's Volvo wagon. It exploded." I closed my eyes. "Regina?" "Also DOA. For whatever it's worth, they probably didn't..." "Suffer," I finished. "Bullshit, they suffered plenty." I felt tears and choked them back. Mercer said nothing. "All 3 of them," I muttered. "Oh, Jesus Christ, all 3. The driver of the truck broke his arm. That was the worst of it for him. He said that there were 3 people in the car, Dennis."
3?
"Yes. And he said they appeared to be struggling." Mercer looked at me frankly. "We're going on the theory that they picked up a bad news hitchhiker who escaped after the accident and before the troopers arrived." "But that was ridiculous if you knew Regina Cunningham," I thought. "She would no more pick up a hitchhiker than she would wear slacks to a faculty tee. The things you did, and those you never did, were firmly set in Regina Cunningham's mind, as if in cement, you could say." It had been LeBay. He couldn't be both places at once, that was the thing. And at the end, when he saw how things were going in Darnell's garage, he had abandoned Christine and had tried to go back to Arnie. What had happened then was anyone's guess. But I thought then, and do now, that Arnie fought him and earned at least a draw. "Dead," I said. And now the tears did come. I was too weak and low to stop them. I hadn't been able to keep him from getting killed after all. Not the last time. Not when it really mattered. Others maybe, but not Arnie. Tell me what happened, Mercer said. He put his book on the bed table and leaned forward. Tell me everything you know, Dennis, from first to last. What has Lee said? I asked, and how is she?
She spent Friday night here under observation, Mercer told me. She had a concussion and a scalp laceration that took a dozen stitches to close. No marks on her face. Lucky, she's a very pretty girl.
She's more than that, I said. She's beautiful.
She won't say anything, Mercer said, and a reluctant grin of admiration, I think, slanted his face to the left. Not to me, not to her father. He is, shall we say, in a state of high piss-off about the whole thing. She says it's your business what to tell and when to tell.
He looked at me thoughtfully.
Because she says you're the one who ended it.
I didn't do such a great job, I muttered. I was still trying to cope with the idea that Arnie could possibly be dead. It was impossible, wasn't it? We had gone to Camp Winnesko in Vermont together when we were 12, and I got homesick and told him I was going to call and tell my parents they had to come get me. Arnie said if I did, he'd tell everybody at school that the reason I came home early was that they caught me eating boogers in my bunk after lights out and expelled me. We climbed the tree in my backyard to the very top fork and carved our initials there. He used to sleep over at my house, and we'd stay up late watching shock theater crouched together on the sofa under an old quilt. We ate all those clandestine Wonder Bread sandwiches. When he was 14, Arnie came to me, scared and ashamed because he was having these sexy dreams, and he thought they were making him wet the bed. But it was the ant farms my mind kept coming back to. How could he be dead when we had made those ant farms together? Dear Christ, it seemed like only a week or two ago, those ant farms. So how could he be dead? I opened my mouth to tell Mercer that Arnie couldn't be dead. Those ant farms made the very idea absurd. Then I closed my mouth again. I couldn't tell him that. He was just a guy. Arnie, I thought. Hey, man, it's not true, is it? Jesus Christ, we still got too much to do. We never even double-dated at the drive-in yet.
What happened? Mercer asked again. Tell me, Dennis.
You'd never believe it, I said thickly.
You might be surprised what I'd believe, he said. And you might be surprised what we know. A fellow named Junkins was the chief investigator on this case. He was killed not so very far from here. He was a friend of mine, a good friend. A week before he died, he told me that he thought something was going on in Libertyville that nobody would believe. Then he was killed. With me, that makes it personal. I shifted positions cautiously.
He didn't tell you any more?
He told me that he believed he had uncovered an old murder, Mercer said, still not taking his eyes from mine. But it didn't much matter, he said, because the perpetrator was dead.
Lee Bay, I muttered, and thought that if Junkins had known about that, it was no wonder Christine had killed him, because if Junkins had known that, he had been much too close to the whole truth. Mercer said,
Lee Bay was the name he mentioned. He leaned closer. And I'll tell you something else, Dennis. Junkins was one hell of a driver. When he was younger, before he got married, he used to run stockers at Philly Plains, and he won his share of checkered flags. He went off the road doing better than 120 in a Dodge Cruiser with a Hemi engine. Whoever was chasing him, and we know someone was, had to be one hell of a driver.
Yeah, I said, he was.
I came by myself. I've been here for 2 hours waiting for you to wake up. I was here until they kicked me out last night. I don't have a stenographer with me, I don't have a tape recorder, and I assure you that I'm not wearing a wire. When you make a statement, if you ever have to, that'll be a different ballgame. But for now, it's you and me. I have to know, because I see Rudy Junkinson's wife and Rudy Junkinson's kids from time to time. You dig?
I thought it over. For a long time, I thought it over, nearly 5 minutes. He sat there and let me do it. At last I nodded.
Okay, but you're still not going to believe it.
We'll see, he said.
I opened my mouth with no idea of what was going to come out. He was a loser, you know, I said. Every high school has to have at least two. It's like a national law. Everyone's dumping ground, only sometimes they find something to hold on to and they survive. Arnie had me. And then he had Christine. I looked at him, and if I had seen the slightest wrong flicker in those gray eyes that were so unsettlingly like Arnie's, well, if I had seen that, I think I would have clammed up right there and told him to put it on his books in whatever way seemed the most plausible and to tell Rudy Junkins and Skids whatever the hell he pleased. But he only nodded, watching me closely. I just wanted you to understand that, I said. And then a lump rose in my throat, and I couldn't say what I maybe should have said next. Lee Cabot came later. I drank some more water and swallowed hard. I talked for the next 2 hours. At last I finished. There was no big climax. I simply dried up, my throat sore from so much talking. I didn't ask if he believed me. I didn't ask him if he was going to have me locked up in a loony bin or give me a liar's medal. I knew that he believed a great deal of it because what I knew dovetailed too well with what he knew. What he thought about the rest of it, Christine and LeBay and the past reaching out its hands toward the present, that I didn't know. And don't to this day, not really. A little silence fell between us. At last he slapped his hands down on his thighs with a brisk sound and got to his feet. Well, he said, your folks will be waiting to visit you, no doubt. Probably, yeah. He took out his wallet and produced a small white business card with his name and number on it. I can usually be reached here, or someone will throw me a relay. When you speak to Lee Cabot again, would you tell her what you've told me and ask her to get in touch? Yes, if you want. I'll do that. Will she corroborate your story? Yes. He looked at me fixedly. I'll tell you this much, Dennis, he said. If you're lying, you don't know you are. He left. I only saw him once more, and that was at the triple funeral for Arnie and his parents. The papers reported a tragic and bizarre fairy tale. Father killed in driveway car accident, while mother and son are killed on Pennsylvania Turnpike. Paul Harvey used it on his program. No mention was made of Christine being at Darnell's garage. My family came to visit that night. And by then I was feeling much easier in my mind. Part of it was bearing my bosom to Mercer, I think. He was what one of my psych profs in college called an interested outsider, the sort it's often easiest to talk to. But a great lot of the way I felt was due to a flying late afternoon visit by Dr. Arroway. He was out of temper and irascible with me, suggesting that next time I just take a chainsaw to the goddamn leg and save us all a lot of time and trouble. But he also informed me, grudgingly I think, that no lasting damage had been done, he thought. He warned me that I had not improved my chances of ever running in the Boston Marathon, and left. So the family visit was a gay one, due mostly to Ellie, who prattled on and on about that upcoming cataclysm, her first date. A pimply, bullet-headed nerd named Brandon Herling had invited her to go roller skating with him. My dad was going to drive them. Pretty cool. My mother and father joined in, but my mother kept throwing anxious, don't forget, glances at Dad. And he lingered after Mom had taken Elaine out. What happened? He asked me. Lee told her father some crazy story about cars driving themselves and little girls who were dead and I don't know what all. He's damn near wild. I nodded. I was tired, but I didn't want Lee catching hell from her folks or have them thinking she was either lying or nuts. If she was going to cover me with Mercer, I would have to cover her with her mother and father. All right, I said. It's a bit of a story. You want to send Mom and Ellie around for a mall or something? Or maybe you better tell them to go to a movie. That long? Yeah, that long. He looked at me, his gaze troubled. Okay, he said. Shortly after, I told my story a second time. Now I've told it a third. And third time, so they say, pays for all. Rest in peace, Arnie. I love you, man. Epilogue. I guess if this was a made-up story, I would end it by telling you how the broken-legged knight of Darnell's garage wooed and won the lady fair, she of the pink nylon scarf and the arrogant Nordic cheekbones. But that never happened. Lee Cabot is Lee Ackerman now.
She's in Taos, New Mexico, married to an IBM customer service rep. She sells Amway in her spare time. She has two little girls, identical twins, so I guess she probably doesn't have all that much spare time. I keep up on her doings after a fashion. My affection for the lady never really faded. We trade cards at Christmas, and I also send her a card on her birthday because she never forgets mine, that sort of thing. There are times when it seems a lot longer than 4 years. What happened to us? I don't really know. We went together for 2 years, slept together very satisfactorily, went to school together, drew, and were friends with each other. Her father shut up about our crazy story after my father talked with him, although he always regarded me after that as something of a dubious person. I think that both he and Mrs. Cabot were relieved when Lee and I went our separate ways. I could feel it when we started to drift apart, and it hurt me. It hurt a lot. I craved her in a way you continue to crave some substance on which you have no more physical dependency. Candy, tobacco, Coca-Cola. I carried a torch for her, but I'm afraid I carried it self-consciously and dropped it with an almost unseemly haste. And maybe I do know what happened. What happened that night in Darnell's garage was a secret between us. And of course lovers need their secrets, but this wasn't a good one to have. It was something cold and unnatural. Something that smacked of madness, and worse than madness, it smacked of the grave. There were nights after love when we would lie together in bed, naked, belly to belly. And that thing would be between us, Roland D. LeBay's face. I would be kissing her mouth or her breasts or her belly, warm with rising passion, and I would suddenly hear his voice. That's about the finest smell in the world, except for pussy. And I would freeze, my passion all steam and ashes. There were times, God knows, when I could see it in her face as well. The lovers don't always live happily ever after, even when they've done what seemed right as well as they could do it. That's something else it took 4 years to learn. So we drifted apart. A secret needs two faces to bounce between. A secret needs to see itself in another pair of eyes. And although I did love her, all the kisses, all the endearments, all the walks arm in arm through blowing October leaves, none of those things could quite measure up to that magnificently simple act of tying her scarf around my arm. Lee left college to be married. And then it was goodbye, Drew, and hello, Taos. I went to her wedding with hardly a qualm. Nice fella. Drove a Honda Civic. No problems there. I never had to worry about making the football squad. Drew doesn't even have a football squad. Instead, I took an extra class each semester and went to summer school for 2 years, in the time when I would have been sweating under the August sun, hitting the tackling dummies, if things had happened differently. As a result, I graduated early. 3 semesters early, in fact. If you met me on the street, you wouldn't notice a limp, but if you walked with me 4 or 5 miles, I do at least 3 miles every day as a matter of course, that physical therapy stuff sticks. You'd notice me starting to pull to the right a little bit. My left leg aches on rainy days and on snowy nights. And sometimes when I have my nightmares, they are not so frequent now, I wake up sweating and clutching at that leg where there is still a hard bulge of flesh above the knee. But all my worries about wheelchairs, braces, and build-up heels proved thankfully hollow. And I never liked football that well anyway. Michael, Regina, and Arnie Cunningham were buried in a family plot in the Libertyville Heights Cemetery. No one went out to the graveside but members of the family. Regina's people from Ligonier, some of Michael's people from New Hampshire and New York, a few others. The funeral was 5 days after that final hellish scene in the garage. The coffins were closed. The very fact of those 3 wooden boxes lined up on a triple bier like soldiers struck my heart like a shovelful of cold earth. The memory of the ant farms couldn't stand against the mute testimony of those boxes. I cried a little. Afterward, I rolled myself down the aisle toward them and put my hand tentatively on the one in the center, not knowing if it was Arnie's or not, not caring. I stayed that way for quite a while, head down. And then a voice said behind me, "Want to push back out to the vestry, Dennis?" I craned my neck around. It was Mercer, looking neat and lawyerly in a dark wool suit. "Sure," I said. "Just give me a couple of seconds, okay?" "Fine." I hesitated and then said, "The papers say Michael was killed at home,
That the car rolled over him after he slipped on the ice or something.
Yes, he said.
You're doing?
Mercer hesitated.
It makes things simpler.
His gaze shifted to where Lee was standing with my folks. She was talking with my mother, but looking anxiously toward me.
Pretty girl, he said.
He had said it before in the hospital.
I'm going to marry her someday, I said.
I wouldn't be surprised if you did, Mercer replied.
Did anyone ever tell you that you've got the balls of a tiger?
I think Coach Puffer did, I said, once. He laughed. You ready for that push, Dennis? You've been down here long enough. Let it go.
Easier said than done.
He nodded.
Yeah, I guess so.
Will you tell me one thing? I asked. I have to know.
I will if I can.
What did...
I had to stop and clear my throat.
What did you do with the pieces?
Why, I saw to that myself, Mercer said. His voice was light, almost joking, but his face was very, very serious. I had two fellows from the local police run all those pieces through the crusher out back of Darnell's garage. Made a little cube about so big, he held his hands about 2 feet apart. One of those guys got a hell of a bad cut, took stitches. Mercer suddenly smiled. It was the bitterest, coldest smile I've ever seen. He said it bit him. Then he pushed me up the aisle to where my family and my girl stood waiting for me. So, that's my story, except for the dreams. I'm 4 years older, and Arnie's face has grown hazy to me, a browning photograph from an old yearbook. I never would have believed that could happen, but it has. I made it through, made the transition from adolescence to manhood, whatever that is. Somehow I've got a college degree on which the ink is almost dry, and I've been teaching junior high history. I started last year, and two of my original students, Buddy Repperton types, both of them, were older than I was. I'm single, but there are a few interesting ladies in my life. And I hardly think of Arnie at all, except in the dreams. The dreams aren't the only reason I've set all this down. There's another, which I'll tell you in a moment. But I would be lying if I said the dreams weren't a big part of the reason. Maybe it's an effort to lance the wound and clean it out. Or maybe it's just that I'm not rich enough to afford a shrink. In one of the dreams, I am back where the funeral service was held. The three coffins are on their triple bier, but the church is empty except for me. In the dream, I am on crutches again, standing at the foot of the central aisle back by the door. I don't want to go down there, but my crutches are pulling me along, moving by themselves. I touch the middle coffin. It springs open at my touch, and lying inside in the satin interior is not Arnie, but Roland de Libay, the putrescent corpse in an army uniform. As the bloated smell of gassy decay rushes out at me, the corpse opens its eyes. Its rotting hands, black and slimy with some fungoid growth, grope upward and find my shirt before I can back away. And it pulls itself up until its glaring, reeking face is only inches from mine. And it begins to croak over and over again. Can't beat that smell, can you? Nothing smells this good. Except for pussy. Except for pussy. Except for pussy. I try to scream, but I can't scream, because LeBay's hands have settled in a noxious, tightening ring around my throat. In the other dream, and this one is somehow worse, I've finished with a class or proctoring a study hall at Norton Junior High, where I teach. I pack my books back into my briefcase, stuff in my papers, and leave the room for my next class. And there in the hall, packed in between the industrial gray lockers lining it, is Christine, brand new and sparkling, sitting on four new white wall tires, a chrome winged victory hood ornament tilting toward me. She is empty, but her engine guns and falls off, guns and falls off, guns and falls off. In some of the dreams, the voice from the radio is the voice of Richie Valens, killed long ago in a plane crash with Buddy Holly and J.P. Richardson, the big bopper. Richie is screaming La Bamba to a Latin beat, and as Christine suddenly lunges toward me, laying rubber on the hall floor and tearing open locker doors on either side with her door handles, I see that there is a vanity plate on the front, a grinning white skull on a dead black field. Imprinted over the skull are the words, "Rock and roll will never die." Then I wake up, sometimes screaming, always clutching my leg. But the dreams are fewer now. Something I read in one of my psych classes, I took a lot of them, maybe hoping to understand things that can't be understood. is that people dream less as they grow older. I think I'm going to be all right now. Last Christmas season, when I sent Lee her annual card, I added a line to my usual note on the back. Below my signature, on impulse, I scribbled, "How are you dealing with it?" Then I sealed the card up and mailed it before I could change my mind. I got a postcard back a month later. It showed the new Taos Center for the Performing Arts on the front. On the back was my address and a single flat line. Dealing with what? L. One way or another, I guess we find out things we have to know. Around the same time, it seems as though it's around Christmas that my thoughts turn to it the most often, I dropped Rick Mercer a note because the question had been on my mind more and more, gnawing at me. I wrote and asked him what had become of the block of scrap metal that had once been Christine. I got no answer. But time is teaching me how to deal with that, too. I think about it less. I really do. So here I am, at the tag end of everything, old memories and old nightmares all bundled into a neat sheaf of pages. Soon I will put them in a folder and put the folder in my file cabinet and lock that drawer, and that will be the end. But I told you there was something else, didn't I? Some other reason for writing it all down. His single-minded purpose. His unending fury. I read it in the paper a few weeks ago. Just an item that got put on the AP wire because it was bizarre, I suppose. Be honest, Gilder. I can hear Arnie saying, so I will. It was that item that got me going, more than all the dreams and old memories. The news item was about a guy named Sander Galton, whose nickname, one would logically assume, must have been Sandy. This Sander Galton was killed out in California, where he was working at a drive-in movie theater in L.A. He was apparently alone, closing up shop for the night after the movie had ended. He was in the snack bar. A car ripped right through one of the walls, plowed through the counter, smashed the popcorn machine, and got him as he was trying to unlock the door to the projection booth. The cops knew that was what he was doing when the car ran him down, because they found the key in his hand. I read that item, headed Bizarre Murder by Car in Los Angeles, and I thought of what Mercer had told me, that last thing. He said it bit him. Of course it's impossible, but it was all impossible to start with. I keep thinking of George LeBay in Ohio, his sister in Colorado, Lee in New Mexico. What if it started again? What if it's working its way east, finishing the job? Saving me for last? His single-minded purpose. His unending fury. End of Christine by Stephen King. Narrated by Bob Askey in the studios of Talking Books Publishing Company for the Library of Congress. June 1983. For special distribution, as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, The Viking Press, 40 West 23rd Street, New York, New York, 10010.